Good morning, Jake. How are you doing?
I'm well. Nice to see you and have a look around the new house and see the cidery being prepared for harvest. Well done.
Yeah, it's nearly upon us, isn't it? But we're going to talk about the year that's been and the past, really. So can I start by asking you, please, to introduce yourself, your cider company, tell us where you're based and how long you've been making cider and perry.
I'm James Marsden. I'm the owner and maker at Greg's Pit Cider and Perry. And this will be our 26th vintage. I made my first barrel of perry in 1994 and made a bit of cider through the 90s as well. And we're now making 6,500 litres in a typical year. But there aren't many typical years, as we both know. And this one certainly won't be a typical year.
Yeah, and so where is it based?
We're based at Muchmarkle, on a little tump up a track, 400 yards off the Dimmock Road.
Brilliant. And so what? Where did the name come from?
The name comes from a hole in the ground. There is a pit, and it's a marl pit. Grey marl was used with baked lime to make the mortar infill panels for many of the timber framed houses. And so this marl pit is in what we call the Greg's Pit Orchard, and it is the Greg's Pit. And the old geezers would have driven an ox cart in one end, filled it up with marl, driven it out the other. It's quite a big hole, full of newts now, and I'm breeding moorhens, so rather lovely. And it stays full of water throughout the summer. But the pit gives its name, or gave its name, to a pear. We have our own indigenous variety of perry pear, the Greg's Pit, and the mother tree is still in that orchard. You can see it's a vast tree, perhaps 3 metres girth at breast height, and it has no graft. And the DNA testing that we've had done shows that it's identical to the grafted trees nearby of the same variety, so very special.
That is a wonderful tree to have. And how widely do you think the Greg's Pit variety is spread at all?
Well, I have some other varieties which until recently were very local. I mean, other people are now growing the Greg's Pit because I gave graftwood to Bournemouth Fruit Farm, 20 years ago now. But I have the Ailton Red, which is, as the name suggests, from the village of Ailton, just 5 miles away. And I think there's a lot to be said for the, and I don't think it is a myth, I think there's probably some evidence behind this, that the varieties in the old days only travelled as far as a man on a horse with a wet cloth and the sky and wood wrapped up in a saddlebag. So the Greg's Pit pear didn't travel very far at all. I found it at Cecil's, which has just recently been sold, just on the Herefordshire-Gloucester borders. That's about 2 miles away from home. It does occur elsewhere, but the more recent plantings will have spread it further afield.
Yeah, brilliant. Interesting. Okay, so going back then just to you, can you talk about your approach to cider making or your philosophy?
Yeah. When you're a small maker, and as I said, we're only making 6,500 litres max a year, you have to have points of difference in the market. The market for cider and perry, as we all know, is a crowded place. There's room in the market for everyone, but we try to differentiate our products in a variety of ways. And I would start with 100% juice. I would then say name variety. I would then say single vintage. Sometimes single variety, more often than not though, named blended varietals. I would say that we have a deep knowledge now of variety. We know what works with what and why, simply because we've been playful and experimented over the quarter of a century or so that we've been making. So we've learned what blends work and what proportions in the blend give us that holy trinity, as Tom would say. Tannin, natural fruit sugar and acidity. And we bring that together. Then I suppose there's what my mentor Gene Null taught me, everything about fruit quality at harvest. So we're very selective in what we harvest from the orchard floor. And we harvest by hand, we don't harvest by machine. So we're not picking up any fecal material from the grazing livestock. There are no twigs, no leaves, all of which you'd get if you're machine harvesting. We're picking up by hand. We're discarding fruit that is mouldy or overripe, or indeed underripe. So that approach to detail matters. And then in the fermenting house, well, it's all about hygiene. And we're using stainless steel vats because the conversation we were having earlier, we can't afford at 6,500 litres to lose a 300-litre vat or an oak barrel's worth. It's a big dent in margin. So with the stainless steel, I can be sure I can get them absolutely squeaky clean, you know, steam clean them and sterilise, dismantle the valve assemblage at every filling, make sure the air seal is fully pumped up at all times. There are things that, all of that, and that's just good shed management, mm-hmm. As well. And then, of course, the racking. Making sure that you rack at the right time. Typically, when it's cold enough in late January for the first vigorous fermentation to have completed. So you're leaving as much of the dead yeast cells behind and can wash that out and pump into a clean vat. So those are some of the tricks, I suppose. There are others. That would be a useful summary, probably.
Mm-hmm. And are you using wild yeast or cottage yeast?
Always wild yeast, yeah. Always wild yeast.
Did you ever experiment with cottage yeast?
I only use a cultivated yeast for a very specific purpose, which is when I make a Method Champenoise in-bottle fermented product. And I do that with the thorn pear, which is, as we both know, the earliest pear probably other than Moorcroft that we harvest each season. And I like the thorn for in-bottle fermentation because it's got enough acidity to carry that second mm-hmm. fermentation. For that, I get a lab test done once it's dropped to 1,005 after the first year's fermentation. I'll then get a measured amount of champagne yeast with some yeast nutrient and a bit of sugar started off, closed circuit agitation, then bottle with a crown cap, leave it on the lees for as long as I can, 18 months, 2 years if I can. But I'm generally in a hurry to get it to market because it's a very valuable product.
Yes.
And people seem to appreciate. So the in-bottle fermentation is the only time I use a cultivated yeast.
Right. Okay, and then what about your fruit? So you talked about your orchards. Is that where all the fruit comes from?
Or did you we've got two orchards at home. One of which is a pure peri-pear orchard with Butt, with Oldfield, with the Greggs Pit. And then the home orchard is a huge mix, 113 different varieties, I think.
Wow.
Sorry, 113 trees, 37 varieties. And it's a mix of peri-pears and cider apples and some dessert and culinary fruit as well. And then I buy in a couple of rows of Dabinet and some Yarlington Mill and some Kingston Black from a neighbour at Great Moorcourt Farm, just two fields away. And then I have another orchard down near here, actually, which I harvest, which is Barnet Brandy and Winnells with a little bit of Hendra Huffcap. And then there's an orchard out under May Hill that I harvest in, not every year, but many years. It's a young orchard, which is at altitude and they ripen late and I tend not to favour it. But if I'm desperate to fill a barrel,
right.
I'll use some of that too.
Yeah. And so the Brandy, Barnet and Winnells is an interesting one because you often do that as a blend of those pears from that.
And they come good at the right time for that. It just works. And I discovered that it makes a lovely bottle conditioned peri. As you know, Albert, I keeve a lot of my cider, the late harvest varieties, you know, Dabinet, Yarlington, Chisel Jersey, White Close Pippin, Brown Snout, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But despite what others would say, I think keeving peri is very difficult, and I've never made it work convincingly. I've had some spontaneous mm-hmm. keeves without treating it with enzyme, but I think trying to treat pears in the same way that you treat those late harvest apples doesn't work. It doesn't work reliably. Why? Because the pear juice is typically too acidic. You need those low acid varieties, the Dabernet.
Yeah,
no. You need for a Kiev to work properly, to get that big, thick brown hat. So what I do with the pears, and back to the Barnet brandy and Winnells, is that I rack it carefully, probably two or three times, once at the end of January, once in March, and maybe once again in April. And then as I wait for it to drop to somewhere between 1,015 and 1,012, that's when I'll strike, and I'll filter 90%,
mm-hmm.
put 10% back unfiltered, so I still got some viable live yeast.
Yeah.
And then bottle it into full weight champagne bottle, wire closure, mushroom cork, and 10 weeks. And if you've done your job properly, you've got something special.
Right, okay. That's a really simple, but you need to do it correctly.
You do need to do it correctly. I mean, but I knew we'd come on to this, and it's great that I'm going there. You're leading me to the place, which is this dilemma, which I've learned over time about when to bottle.
Yeah.
Because I've not seen it written down anywhere in terms of the science, but there will be some science, and I'm just going to allude to it. Because you can use the hydrometer, which we all must and do, to avoid making a bomb. And typically for perry, you can bottle a little bit higher on the hydrometer than I think you can for cider. So 1,015 is pretty safe with perry. 1,012, you're fine. But let's say in late August or September, you find yourself with a perry, as I will have, my late harvest Blakeney Button Oldfield. It'll still be 1,018. It might still be 1,020 at the end of August.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? You want the vat clear for the new harvest? Well, the answer is I'm going to bottle it. And I've learned that I can take that risk, because what I think's going on is, by that stage, 10 or 11 months after you pressed, you've got less viable yeast, you've got less nutrient, you've still got quite a lot of sugar going on, but if you've racked it, and then before you bottle, you do that filter 90%, put back 10% unfiltered, you're putting in a safety check. Now, would I do that in April or May? It would be a bomb. But come late August, early September, you're fine. And that's all about the learning. That's time.
Absolutely.
And experience. And writing it down.
Brilliant. Okay. So let's talk then about the 2019 season. How was the fruit? Did you get to make everything you wanted to? And then how has it turned out?
Yeah. We did. We had a really good year last year in terms of the making. It felt like a very relaxed harvest. The fruit didn't rush us. It came when in a very gentle way. You know, we started with a thorn a bit later than usual. I say usual. Thorn now is going all over the place. It can be as early as the 8th of September. Perhaps the latest we've ever pressed thorn has been the 23rd of September. But last year it was about the 15th, so somewhere roughly in the middle. And we pressed a few more croft with the thorn. Then the bulk of our mid-season perry is always the Blakeney Red, Ailton Red and Greg's Pit. And we do the Barnet Brandy and Winnells at about the same sort of time over a 10-week period, a 2-week period. From late September through to mid-October. And we don't press any cider generally until mid-October. And so third week of October, we did the Browns, Kingston Black and Sweet Coppin. Then after that, there's a nice gap. You have time to gather thoughts and think about the late harvest. But that's as I recall it. But of course it wasn't, because I was actually chasing around after the last of the Blakeneys. I was saying in the barn, I wanted some late harvest Blakeney, and it wasn't going to keep. So I had to press it, and I pressed 300 litres of Blakeney Red on its own to blend into button Oldfield that I wasn't going to harvest until 17th November. So I took that risk and it's paid off. I've got two really nice vats of late harvest Blakeney button Oldfield, which are going to go into bottle at the end of this month, early September. And they'll go in, as I said earlier, about 1018, I reckon. And it's drinking really well now as a draft, naturally sweet. I mean, fantastic balance of sweetness, tannin and acidity, really lovely, but not much tannin and gin clear. So I'm really excited about the prospects for that in bottle. To an extent, I'm going to put 24, perhaps 30 magnums down as well, because as you know, I quite like to play with a few magnums.
Well, they're always the star of the show at the Cider Festival.
Indeed. And some of your nearest and dearest have been known acquire them. Yeah, by one way or another.
Okay. So, and then, but then how has this year been, and your bottling and the decisions you
well,
made?
Well, yeah, the bottling, right. Well, it's gone well. Rather surprisingly, the Brown Snout Chisel Jersey and White Close Pippin, which we pressed after we pressed the Dabernet in Yarlington Mill, we had that lovely cold snap, as we typically do from mid-November through to mid-December. So the Kiev actually took 4 to 5 weeks on about five different vats. So I get very twitchy with my Kieving. I've been known to go out with a head torch in the middle of the night to look down the bunghole, see what's happening. And I was checking them. I was thinking, well, yeah, they're coming, but they're not that quite there. I want to see, you've seen some of my pictures of the brown hats, and I want to see them crusty like a cowpat that you know if you're going to tread on it, you'd go through, but you know it's got that firm crust on the top.
Yeah.
And with just a little bit of CO2 beginning to just bubble through, if you see that, that's the time to strike. Get your racking pipe out and get down it. So it was nearly 5 weeks before these were racked. But the Browns Chisel and White Coast Pippin then went quite quickly. I racked it again in January, but I bottled it in April, which is quite unusual. I bottled it at 1012, and it's turned out really well. Somebody's just written a lovely review. I think Cider Shit.
Yeah, Martin.
Martin on Instagram wrote me a lovely review yesterday for that product, which I was very chuffed with. The Dabernet in Yarlington Mill we bottled 3 weeks ago. I'm very, very excited by that. It tasted great throughout. It was seriously ripe fruit. And I just love that balance. We do a blend of 60-40 Dabernet to Yarlington Mill, and it's the richness. It's sort of Keeler marmalade meets salt caramel cider meets West Coast malt. You know, it's a crazy thing, but it works. And you get this richness and dark colour and depth and moussey mouthfeel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just staggering. So that's gone into bottle. Again, we've done some magnums. We've got 750 plus 75 CL bottles. So, as I say, the stillages are groaning. So look out, Cider Club.
Yeah, absolutely. Has the coronavirus this year affected your sales? Has it changed anything?
Do you know, it's been really weird. We all thought, I think, that this is going to be an off year, and of course for the festivals, including your own, the lovely Cider Makers Meet the Cider Makers Day, which we look forward to so much every year and so much enjoy doing with you. I mean, that and all the other festivals that we do, we don't do that many, but the farmers markets that we've done, and many of the camera festivals that we supply. So the draft market has just been awful. But we've bottled a bit more, and we're selling a lot of bottles all over the country. Southwest, North Midlands, the North, Scotland, but particularly London. I think there's a lot of self-medication being going on in lockdown.
Yes.
And so in terms of the numbers, amazingly, we're just ahead at the end of mid-August of where we were last year.
Well, that's great news.
It's quite extraordinary. Not by much, but just slightly ahead.
Interesting. And obviously, talking about bottles then, you had your branding and your premium bottles for a lot longer, I think, than this current wave of new producers, including ourselves, moving into 75s. Do you feel that there's been a shift in consumer?
There has. Perception? I mean, and I had a new customer come yesterday and say, oh, 75s, yeah, that's a way to go. Well, there's a very simple reason why I did this, and it goes back to what we were talking about at the start, about difference. But it's also about simplicity. I think you've still got one of those forehead Vigo fillers.
Yeah.
But you've put a fancy pump on it, and so you can drive it a bit faster than I can.
Yeah, it's not just pure gravity.
Yeah. Well, we're still using a header tank gravity fill.
Right.
And so I wanted to work out how I'm going to make a premium product that I can put a premium price on. And make it efficient, so in a day we can fill a stillage just on a gravity fill, 450, 500 bottles. Sometimes we'll do a bit more than that, but that's a comfortable day, having filtered it the day before. The corker, don't buy a cheap one. It's got to be the full weight, 2.5 grams worth. And if you buy one, you won't regret it, because it'll see you out for life, whereas the small ones break. And Helen works the filler, I work the corker and wire closure, and it's just great. And we have the cricket on.
Yeah, and it's
or the football, one or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the way to go.
Okay, cool. And last time I saw you, you were talking about having three different vintages of Method Champenoise born. Is that coming out soonish?
Not yet. You're going to have to wait another couple of years. But the 2017, I'm super excited about, because by the time it's released to market, it will have had best part of 22 months on the lees.
That's incredible.
And so that is going to be, I think, very special. It tasted good after 12 months. I think it's going to be spectacular after 22. So I'm hoping to release the first of that at the end of this month. The 2018 is in bottle. It's been laid down for 11 months now. And for the first time, I've actually, because I don't do this every year, because as we both know, let me just finish that first point. The 2019, I've got a 300-litre vat of 2019, so which I'll bottle in late September. Mm-hmm. So there is the tantalising prospect, for the first time in 25, 26 years, that we will have three successive vintages of a Method Champenoise. Why is that so unusual? Well, we both know the fruit varies, the acidity levels vary, the amount of sugar varies each year if you're doing it as we both do, you know, taking the fruit as it's given to us by nature and working with that. I've had three successive years for the first time when the fruit quality has been right. The acidity has been high, the sugar level has been right. Just lovely, and big flavours. So I think in 3 years' time, if I can keep back some of the 17 and 18, I'll try and market, you know, a vertical run of three vintages.
That will be mind-blowing, I think. Yeah. Did you notice 2018 being a particularly standout year?
2018 was certainly the Dabernet and Yarlington Mill was... The Kieved cider was spectacular in that year.
Yeah.
The Thorn Perry was very good in that year. But actually, I think the one vat that... and why was it standout? I think probably because the sugar levels were very good.
Yeah.
Last year, the sugar levels were much less good across everything.
Yes, yeah, same here.
But the vat of Thorn that I'm going to Method Champenoise was 1,055, 56... which for the early season pair is pretty good. Mm. The acidity was 3.5, 3.6, bang on the money for what I want to do with it. So you want it in that ballpark for second fermentation, to carry the second fermentation in bottle.
Why does more acid help that?
It takes it through the second fermentation without it becoming flabby. I mean, you need to have a bit of bite on the finish. With the second fermentation, you're going to get that biscuity taste. It's going to drop to near enough full dryness. You want to have enough fruit to carry through, and enough acidity to balance the moussiness of those bubbles, and that's why it works. The one thing we haven't talked about, because that's just set me thinking about our pear spirit, which we make from the mid-season blend of the Greggs Pitt, Elton Red, and Blakeney Red. And again, there's some learning around that. A lot of people have tried to do this, particularly with coming up to the start of the new season and you're wanting to clear your vats, saying, oh, what am I going to do with this? I know, rather than pour it down the drain, I'm going to distill it. Well, yes. Let me give you a red and amber. It's a bit like how I learnt computing. Garbage in, garbage out. You don't put your worst perry or a less good perry into the still. You put your good stuff into the still. And that's painful because you're putting 300 litres in and you're getting diddly squat out.
Yeah.
But you don't put bad product through the still. Why? Because A, it's costing you quite a lot of money to have the distill, not only for the work of the distiller, but also the duty payable. But you've got to hope that it's going to taste decent when it comes out the other end. And what we've learned is the best thing to do is to put in something that is about a year old. It's dropped out to 1006, so all that residual sugar pretty much is gone, bar the sorbitol. So you're not going to get burnt caramel on the back of the spirit on your throat. And you still want to have the fruitiness, the vivacity that you get of a young perry. And that will come through the still and be present on the finish of the spirit. And so that's how we try and do it.
How long have you been doing the pear spirits?
About 5 years now. This will be our fifth year.
Yeah. And you've done it every year?
Every the last 5 years I've done it.
Yeah, that's great. It's really interesting because there's not much of it around. Do you find...
Well, there isn't, because 300 litre vat, if you're lucky, it's going to give you 50 cl bottles, you know.
Have you considered chaptalising the stuff that's going to get distilled?
I haven't. I think there is a risk there. And it goes back to what happens to that sugar in the still. There are two reasons why you don't want raw sugar or residual sugar. The first is, I think it's going to burn. However clever your distiller is, it's going to taint the spirit in the still. You're right to say, well, if you chaptalize, you're going to increase alcohol content potentially, aren't you? And the answer is yes. Therefore, you might get more yield, but you're adding risk. And potentially, you're also going to affect how it tastes.
Yeah, well,
I mean, not only the caramelization, but the taste. I want people to taste the fruit on the spirit. That's you know, you know that I'm always about, I get teased for my phrase, let the fruit talk. Where Tom's all about, and to extent you and your dad are all about the barrels and the mystique and the wizardry of what you can achieve with the oak barrels. I want to use that clean stainless steel to let the fruit speak.
Yeah, so chaptalizers does not fit.
No, I don't think it fits.
Yeah. The last question, where's the best place for people to buy Greggs Pitt?
Well, you can buy direct from us by appointment. We're open 4 or 5 days a week, Thursday through to a Monday, most of the time between 10 and 6, phone or email in advance. In London, through Felix Nash, Fine Cider, through the Pomelier Club, through Cork and Crown in London. Elsewhere, we've got outlets in Bristol, Exeter, Manchester, Durham, Edinburgh, on our website you can see where, but we're spread about.
Mm-hmm.
And we, for the draft, we use the usual sorts of wholesalers. I haven't worked with John Hallam for more than 20 years, but John Reek I've worked with for a very long time in terms of wholesale, and there are a couple of others as well.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks very much for your time, Dave.
You're welcome.
That was a real pleasure.
It's been fun. Yeah, always good to talk.